broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
I have always preferred poems that, like the deep green pools in a mountain stream, combine surface clarity with depths whose mysteries are revealed only upon sustained or repeated visits. Sue Ellen Thompson, Introduction to the Autumn House Anthology of Contemporary American Poetry. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. We're very pleased to welcome poet Sue Ellen Thompson to our studio today to discuss her poetry. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition, Sue Ellen.
Thank you, Hal. I'm happy to be here.
Sue Ellen Thompson's poems have been read on National Public Radio by Garrison Keillor, featured in U.S. Poet Laureate Ted Kooser's nationally syndicated newspaper column, and received numerous awards, including the 1986 Samuel French Morris Prize, the 2003 Pablo Neruda Prize, and two individual artist grants from the state of Connecticut. She's the author of four books, most recently The Leaving, New and Selected Poems, and The Golden Hour, both of which were nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. Sue Ellen is also the editor of the Autumn House Anthology of Contemporary American Poetry that is now being used in college classrooms across the country. Sue Ellen has taught poetry at Middlebury College, Wesleyan University, Binghamton University, Central Connecticut State University, and the University of Delaware. She has given readings throughout New England as well as at the National Arts Club in New York, the Hirshhorn Museum in Washington, D.C., the Carnegie Institute in Pittsburgh, and Galway University in Ireland. She was the 1998 Poet in Residence at the Frost Place in Franconia, New Hampshire, and participated for 13 summers in the Breadloaf Writers Conference in Vermont. Sue Ellen currently teaches at the Writers Center in Bethesda, Maryland, and mentors adult poets. In 2010, the Maryland Library Association selected her as the winner of the prestigious Maryland Author Award, which is given to a poet every 4 years for his or her body of work. Here on the Eastern Shore, we always refer to Sue Ellen as our poet. She lives and writes in Oxford, Maryland, and is always generous with her time and her expertise. Sue Ellen, you were a poet in residence at the Frost Place in Franconia, New Hampshire. What is the Frost Place, and how many frost houses are there?
There are several. The Frost Place is the farm in Franconia, New Hampshire, where Robert Frost and his wife and four young children lived from 1915 until 1920, right after they returned from their three-year stay in England, which is where Robert Frost published his first book. Frost continued to rent the house during the summers from 1920 until his wife died in 1938. And after that, the property was eventually purchased by the town of Franconia. The house and the barn were restored, and it was turned into a summer writer's residence for poets and the venue for an annual poetry festival. And I was lucky enough to live there for 9 weeks during the summer of 1998.
How did that come about? How were you chosen to live in the Frost Place?
It's sort of like the Maryland Author Award. It was a mystery to me. It came out of the blue, but I later found out who had nominated me.
Well, that's wonderful. There are other Frost houses in New England?
Yes, I've spent quite a bit of time skiing and hiking around the Homer Noble Farm in Ripton, Vermont, near my alma mater of Middlebury. And I believe he also had a house in southern Vermont, and he's actually buried near Bennington.
So, Ellen, let me ask you. You're sitting in this living room of the Frost House, and the chair where Robert Frost wrote his great poems, and I don't know which one, but maybe The Road Not Taken, maybe The Death of the Hired Man, or Mowing, or one of them anyway. And you're sitting there in front of the fireplace trying to write a poem. What is your feeling when you know that that chair is sitting right behind you?
Well, there was the famous Morris chair with the lapboard across the arms that Robert Frost used, and it was in the front parlor of the Frost Place, and that was technically a museum room, but I would be lying if I didn't tell you that once I went in and sat in that chair. But I did most of my writing outdoors there on the front porch with its magnificent view of the White Mountains.
Yeah. Well, I think that's wonderful. When did you start writing poetry? And you probably, like a lot of poets, you wrote poetry, but then you got serious about writing poetry.
Right.
When did you begin writing, and then when did you get serious about this work?
I remember writing a little of it as early as grade school and high school, but that was primarily in response to classroom assignments. I didn't take any creative writing courses in college. They weren't really offered. And it really wasn't until the year after I graduated from Middlebury when I ended up living in a mostly unheated farmhouse in Vermont alone for a good bit of the time that poetry became important to me. And I didn't get really serious until I was 31 and about to have a baby, and realized my life was going to change radically. If I didn't start writing, I might never get the chance.
Well, we're all very, very glad you became serious about writing. Your major theme in your poetry appears to circulate around your family and your family relationships. Tell us a little bit about your family and why these relationships are so important to you that you record them in these wonderful poems.
Well, I grew up in a middle-class family. I was the second of five children who basically all got along well with each other and with their parents. When I was in my 20s and first starting to write poems on a regular basis, I remember thinking I could never get anywhere as a writer because I came from too functional a family. And if any young writer says that to me now, I would say to them, you just wait. Wait until you grow up and marry and you have to accept all these strangers into your midst. Wait until another generation is born. And that introduces its own problems and issues. Wait until your parents get sick and die, and the balance of power among siblings shifts. You may think your family is uninteresting, but just wait. It could be a lot more interesting than you ever would have wished.
Well, Sue Ellen, I find your family very interesting. And quite frankly, I find the woman who writes about her family very interesting. As well, because you are very much in these poems. Your most recent book, The Golden Hour, is primarily about caring for your mother during the period in which she was dying from cancer. Tell us a little bit more about your mother and those difficult days, and then perhaps read for us the title poem of that book.
My mother was an extremely healthy and active woman, and it came as a great shock to all of us when she was diagnosed with cancer in her late 70s. At that point, I was living in Connecticut, just a few hours south of my parents, and I made the decision early on that I wanted to be there for every stage of her illness, including her diagnosis and her death, so that I would know what it was like. I mean, that's basically what poets do, is try to convey what something was like. And I also wanted to know so that if and when I found myself in a similar situation, I would be prepared and I would have an example to follow. My mother was sick for just a little over 4 months, and I spent most of that time living with my parents and taking her to her doctor's appointments, chemotherapy, etc. And the only real break I would have during the day was when my parents would go down for their afternoon nap and I could go out for a walk. So I'll read the title poem.
Read the poem,
from my fourth
please.
Book. The Golden Hour. Those final weeks, there was an hour each afternoon when stillness would conspire with the autumn light. They would embrace my mother in her sickbed, and my father with his book spread-eagled on his chest beside her, dozing. I'd stand outside their bedroom door and know that nothing bad would happen for an hour, that I could leave the house, return to find the cat still curled between the shapes that were my parents, and the same staccato puffs of air escaping from my mother's lips. I'd walk the fields behind their house, the endless avenues of dry golden corn stalks leading nowhere and away, and think of those first few weeks at home with my infant daughter, how the world I'd known before, the world of books and men and dinner parties, had abandoned me. The phone calls from my friends at work dropped off, and what remained of my life gazed at me with slate-blue eyes. Once, after nursing, she fell into a sleep so bottomless, the cell door opened briefly and I thought of slipping out, but her hold on me was already too fierce. Pausing midfield, I'd turn instinctively back toward that slowly stirring maelstrom of grief. My mother would awaken to the sound of a November wind quickening around the corners of the house and the sun dropping into its coin box. Sometimes her eyes would flutter briefly, and I'd remember why I kept that child so close to me for years, and how relinquishing her came hard. The hour would end. I'd put my mother's arms around my neck and lift her to the commode. I'd rent a Katharine Hepburn video and reheat leftovers. If it was cold, I'd swaddle her in afghans on the sofa.
This is a magnificent poem, Sue Ellen. Talk to us about the poem itself for just a moment, and then I also have a comment that I would like to make about it.
The only thing that I could really compare to taking care of a dying parent was caring for a newborn infant. Both are very isolating experiences. Your entire world shifts on its axis, and everything that once constituted your daily life is suddenly replaced by an entirely different routine. And as we all know, parents, as they age, become more and more like our children. So what I was trying to do in that poem was to convey, almost to conflate, the two experiences.
Well, that seems to me to be somewhat of a technique of yours, because as I read your poetry, I find you sometimes describing one set of activities with a parent or children, and then all of a sudden we're years earlier, and you're actually talking about weaving in another event or activity. And we'll get to that a little bit later in the poetry. I mean, there were two things about this poem that struck me that I think all of you out there who are writing poetry want to, frankly, pay attention to. And the first is the line and the sun dropping into its coin box. What a magnificent sentence this is that captures the end to some degree of time. The sun going down, and we are paying now into the coin box. But you don't stop there, because we get that wonderful line in this poem, and then we switch, and you say, "And I'd remember why I kept that child so close to me for years." And that line drops us into a whole new depth of me, for me anyway, for this poem. Is that anywhere near what you were conveying with this piece of work?
I hope so. I made a very deliberate decision to have only one child, because I thought that having two would overwhelm me and I would never become a real poet, because I would be spending too much of my time being a real mother. And so, of course, that focused all of my efforts and attention on this one child, who was an absolute delight for 14 years. And then all hell broke loose. And it was during her difficult teenage years that I first began to look back and remember her infancy. And one of my most vivid memories from that time was how strange and difficult it was to call her by the name I had so carefully and lovingly chosen for her. You know, the day before she had not existed. And today, there she was. Shall I read the poem about that?
Please, read that poem and then talk to us a little bit more about your daughter. And then there may be another poem that we want you to read as well. But read the naming for us.
The naming. Home from the hospital, I laid her in the bassinet and thought of the great disservice I'd done her, bringing her into this world with a name I could not say. It seemed false, as if it still belonged to the novel from which I had taken it, as if she herself were a fiction. I carried her with me for days, her head dense and fragrant against my chest. She was a pronoun that filled every space in the conversation, a weight in the bed, a sound that bewildered the cat, whom I found with his paws up against the upholstered railing, staring over the edge. For one whole day, she cried. Her small face reddened and creased, the clenched purple fruit of her hands and feet punched at the flannel in which I had tried to confine her. By late afternoon, I was weeping myself, bereft by my ignorance, my clumsy attempts to console her, unable to do anything but stand there and watch. Then I laid my huge hand, fingers spread, on her torso and made a loose cage in which her body washed back and forth. Her limbs went soft, her wailing ceased, her dark eyes widened and shone. In utter silence she stared at me, her gaze a fact into which I sank like a body relenting in water. Her flimsy chest rose and settled beneath my palm, and in relief and gratitude I said it. I called her by name and knew that I had a daughter.
What did it mean, Sue Ellen, that you were able to name your daughter? I know the poem tells us your emotion and your feeling. What did it mean to you at that moment when you felt that body relax? And to some degree, it was here mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. It was here.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time thinking, as any poet would, about what I was going to name my child. And yet it had never really occurred to me that there would be a person in place of just that word. And I think it was at that moment when I instinctively really knew what motion to make that would soothe her, that I soothed myself and was able to identify the name with the person.
Well, that is certainly a beautiful image of the coming. We have another image of the leaving, and it's interesting with our children that even though we think they may belong to us, they in fact do not. And at some point, they let us know that. And
yes.
read the other end of that in the leaving.
Okay, before I read it, I should explain that I was married in Greenwich, a suburb of London, which happened to be where my daughter made her first big trip overseas when she was 15. She'd never been to overnight camp. She'd barely spent a night at a friend's house. But when she was ready to leave, she went without a backward glance. The leaving. I lie on the bedroom floor, my bed two damp towels, and weep for my daughter, her first trip away from me over dark water, the suitcase with its soft limbs of denim and corduroy adrift in the plane's loose belly. I weep for the islands she'll cross in her sleep, for the fishing boats scattered like rice grains. I weep for the city of London, its domes and spires obscured now by slabs of glass, no longer the city of my marriage, my daughter already a curled fist of fern in my belly as I climbed the steps to the registry, where Queen Victoria brooded in dun-colored marble. From the kitchen window of my flat in Greenwich, I could see the tangled chain of students from the local school for the retarded meander down the street behind their teacher, and I vowed, just send me one who's perfect, and I'll never show her any less than love. Yesterday, she flung an angry arm at me as I was showing her the proper way to roll and pack her clothing. All you care about is order, she accused me, the vast and cluttered canvas of her room its own rebuke. Then she slammed her bedroom door so hard, bits of caulk sprung from the molding. When she left today, I was out pulling weeds, my thumbnail pushed deep in the earth's soft flesh, my face sprayed with dirt, the strength of my back locked against each root hair's fierce foothold. She stood in the drive, her luggage like huge stones on either side. Now she's off to where my life with her began, and I weep for what she'll find there, the wanting and the getting, the having and the turning it away.
I think what you've touched everyone who has ever been a parent with this poem, because we all have the leaving, all of us, of our children. But the beauty to me, anyway, of what you've done here is, again, in the end of this poem, you have dropped us down a level once more. And it's not just a child going away to college or going away to study abroad. But it's also reminding us of our sense of all that's ahead of them that they know nothing about.
Right.
And so we stand, and they have no idea why, mm-hmm. but we stand in fear mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. their future. Mm-hmm. Because, as you say at the end, for what she'll find there, the wanting and the getting, the having and the turning it away. And we watch them leave, and we know that's what's in front of them. But and so you pull us into these poems in this, frankly, in this magnificent way, Sue Ellen. But we're gonna, I wanna ask you about, you write a great deal about marriage, and as well, certainly of your parents, but tell us a bit about your marriage now and the marriage of your parents as you experienced it growing up.
I think a marriage is probably the most mysterious relationship there is. not only to outside observers, but often to the partners as well. You know, what binds two people together is almost impossible to identify and articulate. And so we have to observe and learn from the marriages around us. My parents, who had been married for almost 60 years when my mother died, had what most people would describe as a very happy marriage. And they were not afraid to show their affection in front of us kids. Shall I read a poem about that?
Please, read about the affection of your parents for each other as expressed in, I think the poem is called Remembering My Parents' Sex Life.
That's a little bit of a joke, because in fact, I remember nothing. They danced in the kitchen while supper was on. Bodies pressed, Glenn Miller, all six burners on the old caloric flicking their skirts of flame. The tuneless buzz of my father's hummed accompaniment like an insect trap beneath the music. Pure interlude, six children in 10 years. A pinch, a slap, flesh resonating its applause, a dip and sweep among the tapping pot lids, scattered cats and chairs. They showered late at night, disappeared and reappeared in full nocturnal dress. No bleating springs, no sharp intake of breath, and never anything above the flannel sheets, but one head breathing sleep into the other's nape. I never saw my father naked, and am grateful now for that, grateful that I came into my knowledge innocent and late, that someone had to teach me everything except the music, which I danced to when my time came, as if born to it, in all that steam and clatter.
That's beautiful. There's another poem that speaks of their relationship as well. Would you read that one for us? I think it's called Wallpapering.
Yes.
And anybody who has lived in New England knows how to wallpaper.
Absolutely,
believe me.
I do. It should also be said that my parents were great arguers, almost always over trivial things like rearranging the living room furniture or changing the wallpaper. Wallpapering. My parents argued over wallpaper. Would stripes make the room look larger? He would measure, cut, and paste. She'd swipe the flaws out with her brush. Once it was properly hung, doubt would set in. Would the floral have been a better choice? Then it would grow until she was certain it had to go. Divorce terrified me as a child. I didn't know what led to it, but I had my suspicions. The stripes came down, up went the flowers. Eventually, it became my definition of marriage. Bad choices, arguments whose victors time refused to tell, but everything done together and done well.
That reminds me of a comment in one of your other poems, in which you said that your father always in rating things assigned a number to them, and he if you were in a restaurant or something and the waitress mm-hmm. said how was the meal, he might say, well, it was a 6 or something like that. He asked you once how you would rate your marriage. And the reason I'm asking you this is that I think this says something about the relationship of your father to your mother as mm-hmm. well. So tell us that story, if you would.
Oh, yes. Well, we used to sit around the table on New Year's Eve, and we would all have to rate the year. What kind of a year did you have? And it better be a pretty high rating, because none of us, of course, had any excuse to be anything but happy. And one time my dad asked me, you know, how would you rate your marriage? Well, things were pretty good. I said, I'd give it a 9. And my mother had died at this point, and his eyes filled, and he said, I would have given mine a 12.
A 12. Not wonderful. Let's shift gears for just a minute here. You've written about your family and your daughter and your your marriage. I find something actually, Sue Ellen, very sensual in your poetry. And what I mean by sensual is there is sex, and we're going to hear about that in just a minute. But beyond that, there is something that engages almost all of the senses in your poetry. We have a sense of color, of the vision of color. We have a sense of a tactile sense of touching things, of feeling things. There's a great sensitivity here that touches our own sensibilities. And there are two poems I'd like to ask you to read that kind of hit on that theme. One of them is Fast Food. Would you read that for us?
Sure. I wrote this when my mother was going through her treatment for cancer, which involved chemotherapy and drugs designed to stimulate her appetite, since she was losing weight so rapidly. And even though she had always been someone who was meticulous about what she ate, this one drug changed all that. Fast Food. When the doctor prescribed a liquid called Megase, designed to elicit an appetite where hers had waned to a crescent, it made my mother crave the food she'd spent a lifetime avoiding. She'd lift the lid and start licking her fingers before we had cleared the parking lot at Kentucky Fried Chicken. And once she made me drive straight from her CAT scan to Burger King, where she downed a Whopper with extra cheese and more delight than she'd ever displayed at Thanksgiving. After raising a shake made with real ice cream to her face, she closed her eyes reverently and shaved her mustache with a finger. On our way home from chemotherapy, she made me stop at McDonald's for lunch, and with the same bliss-driven spiritedness said she wanted a picnic. The sky had been lowering its hopes all day, but we found a grassy place on the banks of the Merrimack. Propped by a damp stone, lichen-stained, she devoured her paper-wrapped feast. Her hair, which would fall like the leaves of the willow behind her in just 1 week, caught the mist that rose like a thought of rain in the mind of the heavens. It formed a loose cloud around her face, bathed in silvery pleasure. She held a crisp sickle of fry aloft and gazed at its tip, dripping in rich red ketchup. What could be better than this, she asked. And indeed, I could think of nothing.
And indeed, it's difficult to think of something more sensual than
a French fry.
Wonderful French fry. And read the mowing for us.
Yes, this is about a very bad day in a marriage. My husband was mowing the lawn in Connecticut, and my cat was sleeping under a forsythia bush, and he hit her.
Ooh.
Yeah. But of course, as awful as it was, it made me think of what could have happened and didn't. He could have run over his own foot or hand. The mowing. You would have undone everything. The apples gathered, bushes sculpted into boxcars, silken grass that let itself be cut in perfect stripes, the cat asleep in her summer house beneath the dense forsythia as you moved closer. But when I heard you cry out, when you brought her to me in your outstretched arms, her small head lowered, dark half peeled and crimson as a plum, I knew the season of our innocent routine had ended. Comforts of the house and yard, summer's gauze stripped violently away. That night, we lay like two boats restless at their moorings, veils of moisture gathering where we touched. And while we labored, palm on palm, to coil and stow the day's events, suddenly I was at your back, all tooth and claw and ravenous to have it all, the green, the fear, the salt, the blood, the smell and taste of my living, breathing husband.
Beautiful, beautiful. Sue Ellen, you have a new book coming out in the fall. Tell us briefly about your new book.
Well, this is the book I tried very hard not to write. For 7 years, I've been trying not to write it. But of course, on the side, my poetry has been tending in that direction. And it's not that the subject matter is so different. It's still about family, but it's more profound and perhaps less familiar to the average reader. I return to the subject of my child, now in her 30s, and her very close relationship to my father during the last 10 years of his life. And I use that to explore questions of gender identity and the challenges this poses to three different generations.
And when is it coming out?
It will be out in October this year.
Well, there is so much more for us to talk about. And we will certainly look forward to having you back when your new book is out to talk about that and a number of things that we missed on today. Sue Ellen Thompson, our poet, you are a masterful and sensitive writer, and we'll certainly look forward to this new book in the fall. Thank you for sharing your poetry and your insights with us today on Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. We're going to take a short break now, and when we come back, we'll present a radio drama, Tea at Four. This is an original drama adapted for radio from a short story of the same name by your host, a drama of seduction and betrayal. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
When you listen to Folk Alley, you become part of a tradition that has been handed down for hundreds of years, a link in the chain that includes the ancient child ballads and the latest release from Mumford & Sons. Bluegrass, blues, swing, zydeco, it's all part of the Folk Alley mix. I'm Matt Watroba. You'll also meet the performers and hear exclusive recordings every week on Folk Alley.
Friday night at 9 on WSDL 90.7 FM.
Who says size matters? Short stories are better.
After too many balls went out and never came back, we went out to check.
Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story. From PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday morning at 11.
Welcome back to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. And now for our drama, Tea at Four.
Young and slim, blonde and distant, Amanda Perry rode the stair climber. Her velour warm-up suit rippled in sympathy with her cadence. Her cell phone, next to a tall, dome-covered iced mocha latte, a thick circle of brick-red lipstick caked on the straw, rested within easy reach. Reading a Julie Garwood romance novel, she mashed each step with excruciating deliberation. For all her intensity, she didn't sweat, she didn't breathe hard, and she never looked up. Not even when Harry Greenwood, directly in front of her, slumped over the handlebars of his stationary bike and slid to the floor. It didn't matter that the elderly Dr. Greenwood had recently been her lover, or more accurately, that she had been his lover. The relationship had been discreet and was now over. Only a few people had known about it, including Mrs. Greenwood. In fact, it was Mrs. Greenwood who initiated their introduction and made it possible for their meeting arrangements. A ménage à convenience, one would say. Convenient for Mrs. Greenwood, who was spared the good doctor's advances. Convenient for the doctor, whose interests were addressed. And certainly convenient for Amanda Perry. It was old family sugar money from Louisiana that gave Mrs. Greenwood her slippery independence. Growing up among the elite in Lafayette, Grace Charbonneau discovered early on that her money and social standing purchased a certain freedom from social convention as well as from want. She saw herself as different from her friends. She was worthy of life's largesse and felt obligated, therefore, to involve herself in the manipulation of its affairs. To work her will, she employed a subtle interplay of confidence and innocence, pressure and indifference. It was a beguiling strategy that she perfected by skillfully entwining herself in the fortunes of her friends. The young Grace Charbonneau tasted the sweet power of manipulation and discovered a gratification that was sensual in its intensity. This indulgence she found increasingly difficult to satisfy in the narrow confines of Louisiana, and, enchanted by the interplay of powerful political figures, she eagerly followed her husband to Washington, D.C. With satisfaction, she watched her husband's orthopedic practice grow. His success she saw as an enhancement of her own position, and as long as he remained in tow and did nothing to endanger her standing, she was content. Unfortunately, Dr. Greenwood had his own interests and needs. As a result, he often turned his attention to young women easily charmed by the prominent surgeon and more than willing to attend to his need for feminine companionship and sexual adventure. Mrs. Greenwood was aware of these dalliances, and having extricated the doctor from more than a few embarrassing circumstances, decided to resolve the issue in her own way. At the Golden Garden Spa, Mrs. Greenwood rose from her regular hair appointment and handed Amanda Perry a card.
"Please join me for tea, my dear. The Hay Adams, Sunday afternoon at 4. I trust it's not an inconvenience." "Good. I'll see you then."
The few times Amanda Perry had attended Mrs. Greenwood, their conversation had advanced little beyond pleasantries. The invitation left her giddy and more than a little perplexed. Without a clue, Amanda Perry entered the Hay Adams at 4 o'clock, slender, eye-catching, beautiful in a black sheath.
"In here, my dear. Andrew will sit over there next to the fireplace."
Mrs. Greenwood studied her guest for a moment and, complimenting herself on her good choice, led Amanda Perry to a secluded table in the John Hay room.
"What would you like, my dear? Let's have some tea and perhaps the pettifors. Yes, you must be wondering why I asked you here."
"Thank you, Mrs. Greenwood. I'm quite curious. You can certainly understand."
"All in good time, my dear. Now, what kind of tea would you like? Let's try the Indian spice and certainly the pettifors. You're from Alabama. I notice a little accent. Enough to give your voice a pleasant inflection. Thank goodness you've managed to wash away most of that deplorable southern drawl. Goodness, you pass as quite intelligent."
Amanda Perry was offended, but not unpleased when she dug the compliment out of the insult. She lifted her chin and peered at Mrs. Greenwood.
"Relax, dear. I know quite a bit about you. You grew up poor in Mobile. Your parents reside there still. You have one child, and only God knows where the father is. His absence you should see as a blessing, dear. You went to Auburn University, graduated in spite of some unpleasant accusations. I believe they concerned the manner in which you earned your way."
Amanda Perry was now standing next to her chair, her linen napkin a maroon stain flowing from her hands down the front of the black sheath.
"You came to Washington 3 years ago, have kept yourself going with various jobs, the latest as a hairdresser. But you are ambitious and you are bright. You enrolled in law school, night classes, but unfortunately you are having trouble paying tuition. You date occasionally, but have no steady companion and few close friends."
"I don't know what you want or why you're doing this to me, Mrs. Greenwood, but I've heard enough. Goodbye now."
"Sit down, my dear. I'm prepared to make you a substantial offer, an offer that will satisfy your financial difficulties. I would like to engage you to seduce my husband."
Studying Mrs. Greenwood in the subdued firelight, Amanda Perry felt her way back into her chair. Matronly in her print dress, bathed in firelight, Mrs. Greenwood sat upright. Her arms and white-gloved hands rested on the table, cradling her bosom, an indifferent tilt to her head.
"Seduce your husband, Mrs. Greenwood? A substantial offer. Are you offering me money to go to bed with your husband? Do you think I'm a prostitute? Is that it? Is it because of that Auburn thing? Do I look that desperate? I think you should hire a call girl, Mrs. Greenwood. And that's not me. Why do you want someone to seduce your husband?"
"It's very simple, my dear. I'm looking for someone to occupy my husband, a judicious arrangement that will keep him from bothering me, as I have no sexual interests. Quite simply, my needs are met in other ways. I also wish to keep him from approaching the prominent young women who attend my social functions, as well as those who pass through his practice. You understand, the alliances in which he entangles himself offer great potential for social, and I might add, financial ruin. Most disturbing.
And you want me to provide, let's see, companionship that will distract your husband from these, alliances. A relationship, discreet, of course, with someone you have confidence in who you can control. Do I have this right?
Whom, my dear? And yes, that's exactly right. The devil you know is always preferable to the devil you don't know. Not that I think you're a devil, gracious, but I do believe you would be perfect for this arrangement.
Why, Mrs. Greenwood? Why me?
Why indeed? Of course, why you? My little inquiry into your background indicates a woman who is circumspect, loyal to a fault, honest and straightforward. You have an air of independence, even detachment, an asset that should enable you to check any emotional involvement on your part. But most important, dear, my husband would adore you, and I've never provided him anything but the best.
I'm flattered, Mrs. Greenwood. I guess, but I don't think this is something I want to do.
Of course you want to do it, my dear. You might think you don't, but it will assure your future. For your services, I'm prepared to obtain a responsible position for you in a prestigious law firm, cover all your child care costs, and see that your law school expenses are met. And I'm ready to bind my intentions with a written contract. In exchange, you will work effectively in the position I secure for you. I believe you to be quite capable. Be circumspect in your relationship with my husband, and you must acquire his companionship on your own. Under no circumstance is he to know I am involved or that I am paying you. It would destroy him. And finally, my dear, your relationship with my husband must be monogamous. You must be faithful to him, and you must demand that he be faithful to you. Our agreement will end when, for whatever reason, your relationship with my husband terminates.
I'm not sure, Mrs. Greenwood. I need some time to think. I mean, a man 3 times my age, even if he is a doctor and all.
You might look 23, my dear, but you are 32, and at 64, my husband is exactly twice your age. Unfortunately, even at that, he's a randy, energetic Louisiana bull. Nothing kinky, but certainly well within your range.
I still need a little time to think about this, Mrs. Greenwood. My God, you don't know what you're asking.
Yes, I do, dear. Here, have a petty four.
Pensive, Amanda Perry took one of the little cubes. A small bite filled her senses with a wave of sweetness, followed by the complimentary tang of lemon.
I'm hosting a small reception at the National Museum of Women in the Arts tomorrow evening. Here's an invitation. You can meet my husband there. After, you can give me your answer. He'll be there between 7:30 and 8:30. He loves Mary Cassatt. Study up.
Smiling, Mrs. Greenwood signed the bill and placed a small package on the table.
You may want to wear this, my dear. See you tomorrow.
Except for her affirmative answer the following evening, Amanda Perry did not speak to Mrs. Greenwood again for more than 2 years. Communication was through her attorney or an occasional hand-delivered note on embossed note cards, numbered. As requested, Amanda Perry would write her response and return it with the messenger along with the original inquiry. Mrs. Greenwood was correct. The doctor adored Amanda Perry. The seduction had been simple. At the museum, Dr. Greenwood melted around Amanda Perry and absorbed her understated advances with refinement and humor. Gracious, restrained, and patient, he was a subtle and cunning predator. In a mauve silk sweater dress, wearing the simple diamond necklace Mrs. Greenwood had given her, Amanda Perry savored the irony of stalking the pursuer. Dinner was arranged for the following week. Amanda Perry grew in her relationship with Dr. Greenwood. He was affable, demanded little but her company and her affection. Thriving on his esteem, she delighted in an affirmation that led her to discover an unappreciated value in herself. She was accepted as a woman of substance, an individual and unique, a confirmation that bestowed on her relationship with the doctor an ease and contentment that she had not known with other men. Slowly, subtly, without notice, her detachment, her objectivity, eroded away, and, unaware, the skillful stalker became the emotional captive. Innocent of her fall, Amanda Perry yielded herself to the good doctor. 2 years into her arrangement, Amanda Perry leaned back in her chair in the Golden Garden Spa and felt herself at ease as Ruthie Myers combed out her hair.
Remember that woman whose hair you used to do, Mrs. Greenwood? Well, let me tell you, I understand her husband is quite the Romeo. Apparently, he's been sashaying about with some chicky bird that is decidedly not Mrs. Greenwood. Sophie, on our break, she told me she saw them coming out of a bar in Georgetown last night. I think he's a doctor. I mean, this woman was all over him, arm draped around his shoulders, nuzzling his neck. Sophie said they went off together in a cab.
Amanda Perry had not let the suspicions that drifted through her mind or the subtle warnings in Mrs. Greenwood's notes cloud her contentment. But Ruthie's confirmation shouldered through her denial, and her stomach lurched into a knot. Doubt and insecurity nosed out of the shadows. Amanda Perry overwhelmed them both with protective anger and got out of the chair. She did not consider alternatives, did not judge, did not weigh up. She reacted and went straight to Dr. Greenwood's office. Any deliberation she pushed aside. Concern for Mrs. Greenwood and what she might say, suppressed. The possible consequences of her actions all drowned in a defensive thirst for revenge. When she walked into the office, Amanda Perry's anger had hardened to a vindictive cruelty. She was wounded, cornered, and in a battle for self-preservation. Dr. Greenwood's infidelity had opened in her a floodgate of guilt that made her feel cheap and in some way diminished. Her integrity slandered, her respect for herself crushed. Amanda Perry responded on full instinct, and she attacked.
Is Harry back there?
What's your name, please? Do you have an appointment?
Is Harry back there?
The doctor is with a patient right now. Do you have an appointment? Wait a minute. You can't...
But Amanda Perry was already through the inner door. Charging down the corridor, she invaded three examination rooms before she found Dr. Greenwood. He was probing the knee of a gowned, middle-aged woman, her legs dangling off an examination table. Amanda Perry grabbed the doctor and spun him around.
Who is she, you sack of garbage? No. How many are there? How long have you been seeing them, you filthy pig? You played me for a fool, didn't you? Little Miss Innocence, she'll never know. Give her a bauble or two, take her for a few nice trips, give her a little humpty hump in the hay, and then add her to the list. Is that what you thought? Another little trinket to play around with? Another conquest for your obscene orthopedic ego?
Frozen on her table, knees two white moons peeking out from under her gown, the patient looked at the doctor, horrified. A crowd gathered at the open door.
Just a minute, Amanda. We can talk about this, but not here.
You bet your ass we can talk about this, and we're going to do it right here and right now. I don't care if the whole world is listening. Turn on the intercom. Let them all hear what a slime ball you are. You know, you made me feel like something special. Now I feel like crap. Well, I'm not like Grace. If you think I'm going to put up...
Leave Mrs. Greenwood out of this, Amanda.
Leave her out. Leave her out, you pitiful jerk. She's up to here in this. Do you think I would have given you 2 minutes? You didn't seduce me, you lech. I seduced you. And you want to know what? I was paid by your own wife so you would stop trying to jump on her. Her and every other skirt that came within reach. And it worked for a while. But enough wasn't enough for you, was it? Jesus Christ!
Dr. Greenwood, his face whiter than his starched smock, was slumped against a corner of the examination room. And someone has turned on the intercom.
She loves you, you know. Loves you enough to give you a gift like this. And what do? You screw her over! That's what! And in a strange way, I loved you too. And what do? You screw me over too! How can you throw a gift like that away? Jesus, you must be some sick!
Amanda, I...
Don't Amanda me! Don't call me, don't write me, don't even think about me, you filthy lech!
And Amanda Perry turned and pushed her way through the crowd at the door. Her attack had been devastating. Dr. Greenwood, standing among his colleagues, was destroyed. The snickers, reproving smiles, and occasional outright hostility translated into a loss of confidence that compounded the doctor's depression and hostility. 3 months later, he slid to the floor, a fetal hieroglyph next to his stationary bicycle. As the crowd peered at the doctor, Amanda Perry turned a page in her book, studied her nails, and with a fitting air of interest looked beyond the spectators at the quivering doctor when the chime on her cell phone sounded.
Mrs. Greenwood?
Hello, my dear. Sunday at 4 o'clock at the Hay Adams. I assume you're available. I'll see you then.
Mrs. Greenwood.
I know, dear. I'm on my way to the hospital now. I'll see you Sunday.
When Amanda Perry walked into the John Hay room on Sunday at 4 o'clock, she wore a dark beige suit, skirt cut stylishly above the knee, her white blouse set off by a brown and gold silk scarf. She looked every bit the successful Washington lawyer. A slight gesture from Mrs. Greenwood's white-gloved hand took Amanda Perry to a table near the fireplace.
Good afternoon, Amanda. Thank you for coming. I've taken the liberty of ordering for us a mod blackcurrant tea and, of course, the pettifors.
How is he, Mrs. Greenwood?
Resting easy, dear.
It was a mild stroke. A slight paralysis remains on the left side, but the doctors say that should go away in time. He's expected to recover almost fully. I understand that was quite a show you put on in his office.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Greenwood. Well, actually, I'm not. He made me feel so cheap, dirty even, and almost like it was my fault. Why would I feel like it was my fault?
And who would you rather blame, dear?
I had an overwhelming feeling that I was sinking, Mrs. Greenwood, that I needed to save myself. So I struck. To preserve some shred of self-respect, I lashed out.
It's to be expected, dear. No sense dwelling on that now. But you did tell him about our arrangement. You gave me your word.
I feel bad about that now, Mrs. Greenwood. Though, at the time, it was exhilarating. I know I gave my word, but it was the only weapon I had. I was looking to strike. And what a lovely hammer it was.
Yes, well, it certainly was effective. He's retired now, you know, battling depression, but we'll work him out of that. He is a good man, but you know that. He suffered only one flaw, one unfortunate, fatal flaw. As I believe you said in your little confrontation, enough wasn't enough for Harry. Well, that certainly was the case as far as women are concerned. A fatal flaw. Well, it's not something we need bother with now, is it? Between the depression and the stroke, he's quite subdued. Hammered into capitulation, so to speak. At any rate, I don't expect any more, let us say, undesirable associations. Now, I understand congratulations are in order. You passed the bar last month.
Thanks to your help, and in a way, I guess to Harry's as well.
You don't owe me anything, my dear. Nothing at all. And as for Harry...
Amanda Perry looked down at the table. As for Harry... Yes. What about Harry? One petit four sat on a cobalt blue plate in the middle of the table, bearing its own confectionery rune. Amanda Perry cradled the two sides of the dish in her hands and slowly turned the plate back and forth.
You're sure he's going to be all right, Mrs. Greenwood?
Don't worry about Harry, my dear. He's no longer your concern.
Amanda Perry looked up at Mrs. Greenwood, then back at the petit four. Not her concern. Just like that. No longer her concern.
You knew. Didn't you, Mrs. Greenwood? You knew that I would...
It was quite predictable, my dear. Thank you for not disappointing.
Amanda Perry lifted the petit four. A frustrating anger washed over her. Led down the garden path, completely outmaneuvered, and then it came. Who would she like to blame? Mrs. Greenwood? The doctor? They would certainly do. Anyone other than herself. But Mrs. Greenwood had only opened the gate. It was she who walked through. Naive, she had entered the garden and wondered at the offering. Now she wanted nothing other than to throw the petit four in Mrs. Greenwood's face and flee the John Hay room. The little cake fit so perfectly between her fingers, and in her palm offered a satisfying measure of weight. The hungry smile that tightened Mrs. Greenwood's mouth repelled Amanda Perry, and at the same time fascinated her. She raised the petit four. Mrs. Greenwood pushed a white, square envelope across the table.
I'm hosting a small reception at the Smithsonian next week. I would appreciate it if you would attend.
Her arm cocked, Amanda Perry held the petit four to her lips.
No, I couldn't possibly.
Its sweet smell filled her senses. The white cube with its deep blue design, perfect size, primordial shape, pulled at Amanda Perry.
Of course you can, my dear. I think you'll find it of benefit. Do you remember the sweater dress you wore the night you first met Harry? I know you'll be a sophisticated Washington lawyer one day, something we'll certainly appreciate. But this time, would you mind wearing a similar dress? Silk and clingy. And the diamond necklace. Yes, the diamond necklace. You'll look stunning. There's someone I would like you to meet.
Amanda Perry closed her eyes. Her lips opened. The satisfying sweetness of the petit four rolled across her tongue, rested for a moment, and then yielded to the exquisite bitterness of the lemon.
This is your host, Harold Wilson. A great thank you to our cast of Tea at Four. Lee Slater as our narrator, Judy Hearn as Mrs. Greenwood, Madeleine Slater as Amanda Perry, Angela Bird doing double duty as Ruthie Myers and the receptionist, and Robert Forrester as Dr. Greenwood. And thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
You've been listening to a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with their host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.